as required in terms of the Labour Relations Act. And then just the most important one is the state. Is the state an employer? The state got many departments that the state are also seen as a single employer. And therefore, the concept of an employer organization is really different from what you would find in the public sector. But the importance of the state as employer, especially in certain sectors, cannot be underestimated. And it is therefore the principle that we put to the committee to consider is not to see what is the biggest voice that's coming from employer organization, but to be more inclusive so that those that are affected in that sector, which include all the employers, are represented, even if they elected to be with a small employer organization, or even if it is the state who is not organized in an employer organization structure, but the value as employer that is added through it. Chair, it is therefore the view that the criticism of the role players were more focused on the actual implementation of the levy system rather than to deal with the principle that's applicable there in this amendment bill. And Chair, the issue here is not if there is non-compliance to what they perceive to be a responsibility to all employers. That's a separate matter which must be dealt with in a separate forum. But the principle here is to say, is this an employer organization which has value? And by dealing with the concept of employer organization, because the state do not necessarily fit into that definition, the state must be included as part of their definition in order to deal with the meaning that is given to an employer organization in terms of this act. So, Chair, the Minister's position of the definition is what the Department put to the committee. Chair, the next issue that's been identified is the reference to the so-called SIC code, which is in Clause 7, which is the new Section 9, Capital B. Chair, this is a provision which deals with the incorporation of a portion of one sector into another. Chair, the current situation is that this standard identification codes are used. This is the structure which is currently the yardstick or the requirement that is used in the demarcation of the CETA landscape to identify the 21 CETAs. To refer to any other code system, even if it might be better, would lead to confusion, would lead to instability, and would mean that the whole there must be a recomposition of all the CETAs, which would, I think, be very disruptive. Chair, so there's also no clear research to indicate that the industrial standard identification code is better than the standard identification code. So, Chair, they need more work before this position can be implemented. It's not necessarily a bad idea, but at this point in time, it is not, or it is the advice of the department that it is not the suitable time to consider this proposal. Chair, because the specific section or clause is dealing with a system which is currently in place, and it is providing the legal framework to deal with any incorporation that might happen within the lifespan of this CETA landscape that's currently in South Africa. Chair, the next issue that's been raised is that of the ministerial appointment. Chair, it's an interesting terminology because all the members are appointed by the the minister, and therefore all the members, including the chair, are ministerial appointments. Chair, I think what the role players try to allude to is to refer to those appointments that are made from the four constituencies consisting of departments other than employers, the bargaining council, the professional bodies, and organizations in communities. So, Chair, the principle behind that is to say, when you look at a composition, a membership, there is a need to have also the voice of other constituencies than the employer and the labor constituencies. The members that must be nominated by these two or those four category of role players within that on that specific provision of the clause 9 section 11(2)(b)(3), Chair, they must comply with the same requirements as any of the other members. They must have knowledge. They must have experience. They must comply with the general requirements of gender. They must also comply with the addressing disadvantaged communities and persons. So, Chair, to say that those members do not have a place to play a meaningful role is not justified if you look at the broader context of the legislation. And Chair, it is important that in order to avoid the situation that you get two powerful blocks, on the one hand the employee organization, on the other hand the employee organization, going long ahead all the time in meetings, is not encouraged. By having a third component which can sway the vote to either side is a good principle in any organization. So, Chair, it is our view that once again the position as put in the bill is more justified, and the reasons provided is sufficient to request the committee to remain with the position as is in the bill. Chair, the next issue that's been raised was raised by one in an oral presentation by HW CETA and Quad Para Association of South Africa in a written one. And that is to say, committee, you must consider the fact that bodies like collective bargaining councils have the main constituencies of employer and employees has already been presented, and therefore they should not be given a further opportunity to be represented. And furthermore, if you look at the membership of the community, they also feel that it is better to replace that with the organizations representing disability. Chair, the approach in the bill is to not only limit the denominations for people with disability to those two members, but to put it as a general requirement that the minister must look at the composition of the accounting authority as a whole and must apply the principle that there is people who've been disadvantaged advantage persons or organizations, then that person must also be represented. And that is not only to the two members, but it is to all 14 members. So the chances of getting, through that provision, a person to represent also the interests of your disability sector is therefore much larger and is also well protected within the current law. There could not be any justification to take our organizations in community as they allege. There's no rationale which the department could gather from their presentations to justify it. And Chair, as to the bargaining structures, yes, it is not to say that the bargaining structures will be, that nomination will be accepted. The minister will balance it on the basis of the role that such structure plays within the sector. And Chair, it is there's four categories or role players who will make nominations to two members within that category or constituency. And therefore, there's no guarantee. Even if disability is being put into that, there's no guarantee that that member will be appointed. So, Chair, once again, the department is of the view that the protection that they seek is already in the legislation, and therefore the language as used in the bill is therefore sufficient to address their concerns. Chair, the next issue that has been raised is the issue of the chairperson, that the chairperson is appointed by the minister and that the chairperson has no voting rights. Chair, what is very important is the fact that there's quite a support for the chairperson to be appointed by the minister. That is also the dissenting voice to say the chairperson is part of the constituencies and should be elected from the constituencies. But here it is also a well accepted principle, which is a policy position that underpins this piece of legislation, to say that the chairperson must be an independent chairperson, a person who is not having a direct link with the various constituencies through nominations and elections, but rather to deal with it in a professional and an independent manner and enhance the efficiency of it, of that meetings through leadership, which is bringing the various role players together. Chair, you've indicated that the model of using constituencies similar to the NEDLAC model might not be the best option, and it might be an issue that needs to be considered in future. But by using an independent chair, it provides at least some stability within that structure in order to deal with constituencies and to move the different positions away from a hard mandate to the best interests of the sector as a whole. And Chair, it is therefore important that the chairperson is appointed by the minister, but not from the constituencies, but in order to keep that independency, it is also important that the chairperson do not have voting rights, except if there is an equality of vote. And Chair, the reason for that is we are not living in the perfect world. You're going to get that situation. And somewhere along the line, you must break that stalemate. And the only possibility is to provide the chairperson with that vote. And Chair, it is not going to be the rule, but it's the exception that you're going to use that voting right of the chairperson. And Chair, it is also incentive to the other members to get a vote which gets an outcome without involving the chairperson. So Chair, once again, it's a practical consequence. The department is of the view that it is not it's not contradicting the principle of an independent chairperson. It is also important that the chairperson's independence, enhance efficiency and professional chairperson status, and therefore the position as is in the bill is the one that the department would request the committee to favour. Chair, the next issue that's been identified is the issue of the conflict of interest, and in particular to the requirement that there must be a declaration when it relates to partners and spouses. Chair, the department didn't pick it up that there is a resistance to the concept of a conflict of interest. But here, it is a very important principle, and it is flowing from the King III report, that any direct or indirect favouring to a decision maker should not be allowed. And there's no doubt that if there is a direct a benefit to a spouse or a partner to a member of the CETA, that that would lead to at least an indirect benefit, but in most cases even a direct benefit. And therefore, Chair, it is a principle that has been debated in this committee, in the other legislation, and it was well accepted during that process. And Chair, the view of the department is that this position as stated in the bill is not only the accepted one in business across the world, not only in South Africa, but it is also the position which the committee endorsed during this year's parliamentary session. And we once again would request the committee to favour the language as is used in the bill. Here, the next issue that's been raised is to say that here, the appointment of the CEO, as it is in clause 12, the new section 13 capital B, is to identify the appointment to be a contractual appointment for a period of 5 years. And the comment that's been received is to say that the bill is silent on the actual protection to a CEO that's appointed on a permanent basis. Now, Chair, first of all, the legislation is not made retrospectively, so you cannot nullify any valid contractual arrangements which were made prior to this act coming into place. So therefore, you can't say all the permanent appointments are therefore now to be overturned to become a contractual appointment. But what this bill can do, or the act can do, is to deal with future appointments and say, for those that are on contractual arrangements, you let the contractual arrangement run its course, but when you appoint in future, it must be on a contractual basis, and it must be tied to the lifespan of the accounting authority. So, Chair, the protection is not in this bill. That is, the protection of your permanent appointees currently in the system is in the labour law, and this legislation cannot overturn that right. So, Chair, it is our view that it's not only our view, this position of the department have been debated in NEDLAC with the union, and they were all satisfied that there is sufficient protection within the current labour laws in order not to bring any amendments to the bill. Chair, it is once again our view that the current wording of the Act is not in contradiction with the concern. It is in line with that, but it is also sufficient and should not, there's no need to amend it. Chair, the next issue that's been raised by the role players are the issues that relate to the committee, and especially the financial committee and the remuneration committee, prepared financial statements to the audit committee, as is provided in paragraph 11.2c and 12.2c of the Schedule 5. Chair, one must acknowledge that both the Financial Committee and the Remuneration Committee are committees that will work with finances, dealing with financial statements that have an impact on the auditing process, and because their functions differ, it would mean that the documentation and the statements they generate and which they use in order to take their decisions will also differ. And Chair, there might be an overlap, but it is justified that all the documentation are sent through to the audit committee to ensure that the audit committee, in auditing that funds, are in a position to consider all relevant documentation. And even if there is an overlap, it is justified, but it is our view that it's not necessary an overlap. It is different functions with different documentation, and therefore the need to have both committees submitting those statements to the audit committee is justified. And therefore, once again, it is our view that the language used in the bill is suffice and is necessary to deal with the practicalities within the relationships between different committees. Chair, the next issue is the one of a quorum, and that the quorum might be too high, as it is stated in clause 28, schedule 5, paragraph 15, sub 4b. Chair, once again, one must look at what is in the essence of that clause, that paragraph. Chair, it provides that there must be 50% of membership plus one. Of that 50%, it is required that there must be equal numbers from the employee organizations and the employee organization. Chair, we've got 14 members. 14 voting members. Of that 14 voting members, there must be 7 members plus another one. So, Chair, what it requires is that there must be the 7 members consist of at least 3 of the employer organization and 3 of the employee organization. So, Chair, the other 2 members can be the 2 so-called ministerial members. It can be an employee organization. It can be an employee organization. But, Chair, once again, it is a principle that you just need more than 50% in order to take a decision. So it is not putting an undue burden on any of the constituencies to be present at that meeting. It is not raising it to a 60 or 65% in this process. The issue is you need a 50%, which is 7 members, plus another member. And how those 3 members, those 2 members, sorry, that's required, in addition to the 6 from the organized labor and organized employer, is therefore structured to comply with the quorum, is not putting an undue burden on any of the organizations or categories of organizations and their membership. And Chair, it is our view that a 50% plus one statement is a well-accepted rule in most of the organizations where decisions must be taken, especially decisions of these huge financial natures that you would find in SICAs, which have a real and substantial impact on the sector to which the SICA is responsible for. And here it is our view that the language used in the Constitution is in line with the current approach in SICAs, which is currently used in the Constitution, and therefore is not an undue burden. And we once again request the committee to consider or favour the position as is in the book. Chair, the next issue that's been raised is that of the requirement that the chairperson must vacate his or her position after the absence of 6 months. It is felt that this period is a very long period, especially taking into account the importance of the work of a sitter, and that the lifespan of a sitter is only a matter of 5 years. We have considered it in the department, and we concede that the absence of 6 months might be excessive. It is possible to put a shorter period to address a shorter period. Actually, it is also possible to deal with it by the number of meetings, to indicate that instead of referring to a time frame of 6 months, to say that if the chairperson is absent without a written apology for more than 2 meetings, 3 meetings, 4 meetings, whatever a number of meetings this committee decides. But chair, it is a valid concern. 6 months in a period of 5 years, especially when we deal with it also within financial years, might be a long period, and it might be a period that the committee must consider, and whatever direction is given, we can drop an amendment and provide assistance to the committee on that. Chair, the next issue that has been picked up in the written comments was by the role player that this is clearly a mistake. It is the reference in Annexure 4 of Schedule 6, which is dealing with the situation of a formula which is used in order to determine the nominations which of the organizations will make the nominations in the employee and in employee constituencies, and look into the representativities and then memberships and so forth. But Chair, what is important, this schedule, for one or other reason, is referring to 5 members within each of those constituencies, while the Act is clearly referring to 6 members from each of those constituencies, and therefore it is there's a reference in paragraph 4.7 A and B to the 5 should be 6, and therefore it is supported that this is corrected. It is clearly a mistake. Chair, the next issue is the issue of the Constitution that contains operational matters, and the requirement that the Constitution must be in line with the Act and the Bill itself. Chair, this is a very important aspect. Unfortunately, the role player did not indicate what is this operational requirement that's in the Constitution that should not be in the Constitution. Chair, it is one of the issues that was raised in the NEDLAC process, and where the role players were challenged to say, indicate to us which portion in the Constitution is this would you consider operational matters, so that we can take it out. In the end, they didn't, or they couldn't produce any hard examples, and here they accepted the issue of the Constitution, and also the only point of dispute, as I've indicated before and also in the written document, was the point or the aspect of the voting right to the so-called two ministerial appointees, which they feel should not have been voting rights, and here I'll come to that aspect now. But it is the view of the department that, and we've gone through the Act once again, and made absolutely sure that there is consistency. Chair, that we did pick up one area which one can address in order to align the two, the schedule and the operation or the clauses that deal with amendments to the Act itself. Chair, it is in Annex 4. Chair, if I can just give that reference. It is in Annex 4. It is paragraph 4. No, paragraph 3, 1C, which is exactly the same as in paragraph 3, 1D, DD, and therefore, Chair, it is redundant. It is a repetition and is not adding any value. The wording is exactly the same, and Chair, we can just clean up with the proposal of the department that we just seen up, and I will provide specific a formal amendment to the committee to consider in that regard in their formal deliberations. Chair, but other than that, the department, and also I've had discussions with the state law advisors, we couldn't find any operational matters which is not that's in the Constitution, which shouldn't be there, and furthermore, there's any other inconsistencies between the legislation and the Act itself, the Bill, and the Constitution. Chair, the next issue that they raise is that of the state Constitution as part of the bill, and to include this as an annexure or as a schedule to the bill. So once again, one must look at the principle that is underpinning this step by the minister to deal with it. And Chair, it is also really important that this principle is the principle of having a uniform approach to the constitutions. You've got 21 sitas. Each one which, if you look at prior to April this year, there was a system in place which allowed a set of criteria that the Constitution must adhere to, which is contained in the current Section 13 of the Act, which, if you comply with that requirement, you can put together a Constitution which as unique to your own sector. Chair, the end result being that they will seat us with accounting authorities which run into 60 members. There were others that have, or most of them, have totally different focus and also a different structure and format to the different constitutions, which make it very, very difficult to implement and monitor. Chair, in the end of last year, the beginning of this year, the Minister identified one of the very important aspects of taking control and giving direction to the CETA landscape is to get a more uniform approach. The uniform approach is to deal with specific principles. The first principle is to say a council must be a certain size. It must be a reasonable size to ensure delivery, but also big enough to accommodate the necessary skills and also knowledge, experience, in order to deal with the functions of the CETA. Chair, it also structured it to allow for substructures that provided within the minimum requirements. It also provides a very important aspect, and that is the issue that the membership and also the interaction of the membership with the management, that overseeing of their functions, dealing with the very important aspects pertaining to monitoring of the implementation of their decisions and their policies, must be structured in a uniform way so that the oversight of the minister and also the department can be much easier accommodated. Chair, but it is also acknowledged that if you deal with the constitution as part of the bill, it is a outcome which is upfront. It is known as part of the legislation. It is enforced as a document that went through a parliamentary process, and therefore it brings legal certainty to everyone affected. It takes out of play court challenges, because it is not a discretion of the minister when approving the constitution, or when the minister is opposing it on the basis that he or she is not satisfied with the specific interpretation. And Chair, it is a well-known fact that court cases are not only very expensive but also very time-consuming. And we've also seen that CETAs do not hesitate to challenge the minister when it comes to discretion taken in terms of constitution. Chair, it's valuable resources that goes into court challenges, whilst with this approach, it is a fair process which got the scrutiny of Parliament, the development process being subjected to the NETLAC and the National Skills Authority processes, where both structures not only gave their support, but also there were no dispute, and they approved the approach as not only a sensible one, but a desired one. And Chair, it is the view of the Minister that if the constitution is not part of the legislation, it would create a similar situation than was the case pre-April 2011. Chair, but this also consequences when you allow when the decision is to link the constitution through this schedule to the act
by including it. The first one is in there must be flexibility, because different CETAs might have different requirements, and therefore the different CETAs might have a valid concern which needs to be accommodated. And Chair, the provisions of Section 13 is therefore also very important when this aspect is considered, because it allows a CETA to approach the Minister and to motivate why there can be a deviation from the standard uniform approach. This deviation is justified on the principle of the uniqueness of the CETA in that specific aspect that needs to be deviated from. Chair, it will, now once again, it must be in alignment with the National Skills Strategy, and it is also with the approval of the National Skills Authority. But Chair, that flexibility can allow the Minister to deviate and to ensure that that specific need, that aspect, that exception to the normal rule, can be accommodated within the principle of a uniform approach. And Chair, this is what the bill provides for. Chair, there's also the criticism that if there is a need to amend the constitution outside the ambit of the deviation, that it might be a very long process. And Chair, it is true that a legislative process takes a period of 12 to 18 months. But, Chair, it is also a fact that constitutions are not a document that you would find amendments to every second day. And, Chair, it is also a process that, even if it is not in legislation, would take a fairly amount of time to deal with all the issues. And, therefore, the time frame to amend the legislation and the time frame to deal with it in terms of a process outside legislation might not be that much different from one another. And Chair, if you weigh these concerns up against the advantages of having an outcome that's known, which is accepted as a principle, and there was a lot of support to the uniform nature of the Constitution, that concept is, and also the minimization of the risk of four challenges, Chair, that you weigh that up against this, then it far outweighs any criticism that might exist to this approach. Chair, the next issue that we picked up from the department side is the issue of the frequencies of meetings. Chair, the legislation or the bill currently provides in paragraph 15.1 and 15.2a that there must be four annual meetings of the every quarter of the accounting authority, and then there must be also at least for the executive committee one meeting per month. Here that means at least 12 times a year for the executive committee. The concern that was raised that this frequency of meetings which involve your accounting authority members might be too excessive and it should be reduced. Chair, the department can see that it might be a valid concern and propose that it is possible to consider the possibility of two meetings of the executive within a quarter, which boils down to eight, or at least six meetings a year, which
provide a preparatory meeting for each one of the accounting authorities meetings, and during the period of budget preparation and strategic planning preparation, there is then also another two meetings. But yeah, what is also very important is that when one considers this, one must look at the principle that's underpinning this provision in the Constitution. And that is to ensure that the accounting officer or the accounting authority is taking the responsibility and having a statutory obligation to monitor and have oversight on the activities of the SICA, to see that implementation of their decisions and policies take place, and to force them to consider their responsibility within these meetings. So, Chair, one must be considering a reduction of the number of meetings or the frequencies of the meetings by keeping a balance between this cost of the meetings and the time it takes up with the very important principle of ensuring that there is oversight and monitoring taking place in the institution, and that everything is not just left for the executive, chief executive officer and the staff to implement, and there is no enforcement or oversight of the implementation process of decisions. So, Chair, once again, it is a position that we put alternatives to the committee, and the committee can give direction, and we will be able to provide an alternative wording. Chair, the last issue that's been raised is that of the minister might get a lot of responsibilities through these amendments, and that there might not be sufficient capacity to deal with it in the department. Chair, once again, this is a comment that you always receive in any piece of legislation. In my experience as involved with legislation since 1994, all the legislation, all the commentators usually raise it as a concern, and one must also take it seriously. Chair, what is very important is that the issues that the minister must take responsibility for, which is introduced by this amendment bill, are issues that the minister already started to implement during the new SICA landscape that came into effect in 1 April. And Chair, the capacity that the minister and the department show to get the SICAs up and running at the beginning of April this year prove that the minister and the department do have the capacity to deal with all the issues that's raised here in this bill, and therefore can comply with the responsibilities provided by this piece of legislation. Chair, it might be that there might be different views and different opinions about capacity, but the bottom line is it justified to have the minister involved in the issues raised in these amendments? If it is justified, it is our view that there is sufficient capacity, but even if we are incorrect, capacity can always be obtained, and you can improve on capacity. But the principle of getting the minister involved is what the legislation should be dealing with. There is sufficient resources in our opinion to deal with it, and it is our view that where there is new responsibilities assigned to the minister in terms of this legislation, it is justified, and Chair, it is also really important
that in the advice we received from the National Skills Authority and also the negotiations we've had in ECLA, these responsibilities of the minister was well supported. They were not only well supported, but they were also approved by those structures as necessary, and it is crucial to have the minister involved in all the issues raised in this board. Now, Chair, I think I've covered all the aspects. I thank you.
Thank you very much for your comprehensive response. Take this moment to allow members to engage with the people.
We need to know what is the process when we deal with this document, kind of document, the production of this document. We need some understanding regarding the proofreading and the language and used in this document. What is the Engels vertaal verzorging? I can't even see. You know what I mean? The language scrutiny and the proof, specifically the proofreading, because we pick up many mistakes. So I just need to know from Advocate Barshop, is there a specific project and who is neglecting this job? Then the other question is perhaps something that we can deal with later. I just want to deal with this comment on his document today, document page 4, regarding the requirement that the chairperson must vacate his or her position after an absence of 6 months. I just need to know, when it's an absence with apology, for instance, does that count? And also, if he's not present, in other words, absent due to illness, is there any sick leave documentation regarding his position? And then also the remarks on the bullets, page 36 and 37, the presenter referred to paragraph 3(1)(d) and then also C. If you read those two sentences, they're not exactly the same. So which one is going to be scrapped? Because the one states the double D, if you have a look at the sentence above all those sub-paragraphs, they must achieve a blend of knowledge, etc. And then also the second last word, it refers to the effective funding of the CETAs. Surely it should be functioning of the CETAs. There's a difference there. If you have a look at paragraph C on page 37, they should have an appropriate blend of knowledge, etc. And then that sentence refers to the functioning. So surely there's a difference between must and should, and which of the two paragraphs are going to be scrapped. And then we also need to know, are we going, as members of parliament, get a final document before we have to vote on this document? A corrected, finally corrected document, and will that be next week? Because it's not on the program for Thursday. We need some guidance on that as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. First, I must apologize for not having attended yesterday. I was held up somewhere. I was in the town, the province. I wanted to the nature of being up there. And secondly, just to apologize also, I may show some gaps in the information I've got about the bill. But just concerned, perhaps I'll have more clarity on what the legal advisor has argued in his presentation. I must echo first what my colleague has said. It's a lack of advocate. The document must have been written in a rush. Many grammatical mistakes, but that is forgiven. And the clause that deals with the constitution, the standard constitution as part of the bill, the arguments as concern is I thought we were in the age of constitutional supremacy, which gives prominence to the constitution itself. But now what's creeping in here now is the rule of man as against the rule of law. Now, the minister, at his own discretion, may deviate from the constitution. I really don't buy into that. Perhaps the advisor could give us more justification for such a rule of man to supersede the rule of law as far as the constitution is concerned. Thank you.
Let me just, there is a cell phone that is ringing silently somewhere, which affects the corner of the proceedings. So I'm not too much worried about it, because I don't usually interfere with cell phones. I just hope members do attend to that. Well, I don't think the argument to say that there isn't. No, it can't be mine. It can't be mine. I always make sure I switch it to mine. But that's fine. I'm sure. Maybe it's analysts. Sorry. Oh, yeah. Probably something's wrong here. But it's not this phone. Maybe I've got a new phone with a picture around in my bag. Or a device somewhere that affects this. Yes. Oh, it could be that complex instrument. Okay. The reason that the Constitution, when the Constitution is an element of the bill or the act, then it can be challenged by a court and so on. I don't think that is a correct or persuasive argument. Because in my view, having studied the judgment against the minister, the basis was not that there's no need for a uniform constitution. It was that the people that challenged the minister knew that the minister was exercising powers he never had. That's simple. And they challenge that on that basis. We should be very careful not to make constitutions part of the law in that sense. Next time I want to change that constitution, then this must come to parliament. And I don't think that's a proper approach. If we give powers to the minister to draft a uniform constitution, and that constitution binds everybody, nobody can challenge that. But the minister actually drafted a constitution when this act at that time said the authority, the accounting authority of ECTA, will draft a constitution that must be approved by the minister. So that act was also very inarticulate as what is meant by the approval. Whether that meant the minister could differ with the position of the sitter. And let's not bring that debate to parliament. In parliament, we accept that we need a uniform constitution, and it must be the duty and authority of the minister to draft that constitution, and nobody can defy that. So that when we amend the minister, at this own level could amend it, was not. That constitution applies to an institution that accounts the minister, not to parliament, for instance. I mean, the sitters, we do oversight, but only the operational requirements, they engage the minister, and so on and so forth. I think maybe that one we need to correct. I don't think that argument persuades this committee to say that if the question comes in an addendum of the bill, therefore it can be challenged in a court of law. Unfortunately, you're correct. I mean, If we offer the minister wrong powers, for instance, in that constitution, it can be challenged in the court of law successfully. So it doesn't really, it's not a strong argument. I think we need to refashion that, say we give the powers to the minister to draft that into a constitution, to deviate from it in accordance with the peculiarities of each sector, and so on. That is a good approach that we can look at. I mean, Honorable Van der Wey says something very eloquent last time when he was speaking on meetings. Should we really prescribe meetings in a bill to say have 12 meetings? Because once you can't have those 12 meetings, then it means you've breached the law. I mean, we're trying to help it. We're not trying to say you've done a wrong thing. We're saying the prescriptive laws in their nature would require us as parliament to start saying how many meetings have you had in this year. You did not have 12 meetings, therefore you're acting outside the law and all that. But you can have a critical threshold of meetings that you think if this is achieved, you are able to sustain your function as an institution. That's what I think members were referring to. They're not really saying those institutions must not meet. For instance, the Remuneration Committee, I don't think they meet every month to determine salaries of employees. I mean, we understand that they can even meet once a year or whatever time. Well, I don't think the Remuneration Committee is responsible for daily functioning of the CETA. I mean, at this level, we should be given things which are very convincing. Then I did not see those typographical mistakes. I'm sure Honorable Globals will pinpoint those, then we can have them corrected urgently before we move. But however, we must agree that we never had quite sharp debate about the bill from the stakeholders. They were concerned with issues which could best be solved at NetLeg or elsewhere. But in my view, we agree to give the minister the powers to formulate that constitution, but I don't think it really must be an addendum of the bill. Of course, many people may argue that no, we've seen that with the constitution of South Africa, we understand the context of that constitution, and so on. It had to address other issues in the schedule and all those. But let's not have the practice of making our bills become very prescriptive for us now. Parliament as well would like to deal with matters of oversight than having to be amending a section of the constitution of the CETA system and all that every time there's a problem. It will cost us trouble and time. Yeah.
Thank you, Chairperson. Perhaps just to start with a small thing you've asked about the geographical areas, etc. If the members wouldn't mind going to the top of page 5 of the amendment bill that we've got in front of us, there it seems to me that we're already working with Acts in the year 3002, the very first line there, and I'm going to rest my case there. That is such basic things, and we're not here to prove it on behalf of the legal services. So please then take it on face value if we say that this document, we believe, in a number of instances, represents shoddy work. Chairperson, there are a few things when we consider a bill like this, where I believe before we go to the detail, we should look at some of the larger problems. And it's clear that this act, having been passed for the first time 13 years ago, and it's been in operation for 12, not even 13 years, and it's already gone through a few revisions, serious revisions in five of them. It just shows that the system isn't working. And my first problem is that I don't think what we have in front of us is going to really solve the serious problems. This is just, you know, changing a few things. Cosmetic sort of changes, but the serious changes, for example, for me, is in the fact that government wants the power to only establish CETAs for 5 years every year, every time. And I would like to ask the legal services to just advise us, because what happens is that, and the words there on the bottom of page 3 says that the minister may establish a CTOP or a period certified in the notice. But then in the next paragraph, it says the minister may re-establish the second, you know, once the 5 years or whatever has lapsed. And my question is regarding the labor rights of staff. Can you appoint people on a permanent basis if their employer has only got a lifespan of not exceeding 5 years? Because the argument was there, how could you have appointed CEOs on a permanent basis, well knowing that the lifespan of this entity, that in terms of law, it seems to me that CETA is going to disappear unless something happens in 5 years from now. And the word is not that the life of this is that CETA may be extended, and it may re-establish, and I would like some legal interpretation there. What does re-establish mean? Does it mean it's a new entity, because obviously there's a completely new accounting authority, there's no CEO in place, etc. The other point is also, but that's now really a small one, at the bottom of page 4, right at the bottom, if no agreement can be reached in the manner determined by the minister, again, I would like, in some instances, to say, but taking into account the inputs received, or the parties that are concerned by this. Then we come to page 5, and it's always difficult to say, it's subsection of section 11.9, there, one quarter from the top. Something which I miss in the whole composition of the accounting authority of the CETA, there are a few things that I miss. The first one is, there's no mention made of the governing function. And what we're finding, and I think that is one of the problems that we've been struggling with over the last 12 years, is that CETA accounting authorities couldn't distinguish between their managerial role, which they don't have, and their governance role, which they should have fulfilled far stronger. And again, and that is why I'm glad that the boss believes that the department will accede to our request that once a month meeting of an executive. Then you become very much like the management, senior management meeting of an entity. And I think those lines or those wires have crossed, and they should not have. And what is happening here is that we put such a lot of emphasis on stakeholder representation there that the need for governance has disappeared. I hope my point is made there. The second one is, when we look at 11.2, that is now just above the middle of the page, nowhere do I see time frames which would give the minister escape clauses, etc., to keep the wheels turning should, for example, organized labor not come up with six persons. It says here six persons who must be nominated by organized labor. What happens if organized labor drags its feet, or they have so much infighting, etc., and they cannot get their list down to six? Because what has happened in the past is then they just expanded the list and said, no, let's increase the size of the accounting authority to accommodate each and everyone. Now they're forced into a position of only six people. I can just imagine that on both organized labor and organized employer side, there may be a lot of jockeying for those six positions, unfortunately. And there must be something which will force them to say, if you don't submit within 4 months or 3 months or whatever a reasonable period might be, then the minister can act on his or her authority. And I don't see that. I also don't see any timelines for the minister to adhere to appoint. And I'm really concerned that if the minister must appoint 21 CETAs, each 15 members, it's a lot of administration. And if the minister is waiting and those people don't stick to timelines, that even the minister will be under enormous pressure, and that there might be interruption of services of CETAs, which we cannot afford. Then also, in 4C, it says there that the minister must ensure as far as possible that these people are drawn from the ranks senior officials in the organizations in question. We support the senior officials, except that some of these organizations, it seems to me, are very small organizations. And you can be a senior official in a very small organization and therefore not necessarily need the necessary skills for the governance of that seat. And the right place, we believe, to add that is in the sentence just above that, B4, a blend of knowledge, skills, and experience required for the effective functioning of the CETA, effective governance of the CETA in question, we believe would be a better word there. Then also, in terms, on the next page, 6 at the bottom, it's here about the making public your interests that you may have should the accounting authority take a decision which will affect, for example, your employer, etc. We still believe that this part could be improved. We fully support the idea that people must declare their interests. We're actually shocked to think that some CETAs apparently have not included that in their present constitutions. But we believe there should be greater transparency as well. We would like outside bodies to be able to go into that members register, like in our case, people can go and see what interests we have in relating to, let's say, for example, Parliament. Then also, I've got questions. It's, again, I'm showing my lack of legal knowledge. On the top of page 7, Constitution of CETA. On the one hand, it says the minister must approve a constitution for every CETA, which subject to this act must be in line with the standard constitution. And the next one, a CETA may apply to the minister in writing for a deviation from the standard constitution. And I'm just afraid that the in line and the deviation might, you know, lead to different interpretations. The minister might say, I cannot allow you this deviation, even though we all agree it would be a good deviation, because it's no longer then in line with this act. Then also, the question on under 4C, where it says, is recommended by the National Skills Authority as an essential deviation. Now, essential services, essential deviation, I think it's just far too strong a word to use Then also we're concerned about continuity in the functioning of the CETAs. You know that originally one of the big drawbacks of the CETAs was the lack of continuity. The staff turnover at the CETAs was just too high. And I'm coming back to this 5-year period. I mean, what do you expect when you only appoint people not for 5 years? They will probably be appointed for 4.5 years. Because, you know, the minister has got 6 months to appoint the CEO, or the board has got 6 months to appoint the CEO, and then the life of that CEO's contract may not run beyond the end date of that license, if I may call it, of that CEO. So it's not a 5-year contract that they will enter into, so it's far less. And we believe that we need to build capacity in this regard, and that we will not be able to do that. So within 6 months of their appointment, submit a list of names of 3 persons who have experience in accounting matters to the minister. Now remember, now 6 months is gone without any CEO in place. But then also on the top of page 8, second paragraph, it says there the chief executive officer's term must correspond with the term of office of the members of the accounting authority, but must stay in office for a period of 6 months. If the CETA...
Okay, if Honourable Boyer wants to interject.
Yes, Chair. First, I appreciate what our colleague is doing, but this sounds like a whole amendment from the DA. Now, normally, to advantage us, it's always helpful if you have this in a written form so that you also look at what sounds like amendment, good amendment, other than having the whole of this, because this is sort of a question time, you know, till the second section. That's my special request, because it sounds too longish.
It's a crucial point. if he does have a written submission, but if it's just the natural expertise of interrogating a document before the committee, I might as well allow it. I was going to listen to him, and after listen to Honorable Dexter, and we'll take from there. I'm sure the department is quite aware that they haven't responded to the submissions of stakeholders, and also the views that were injected by members in the course of that discourse. And it helped in the previous processes that if they had just responded very accurately to what the committee was commenting on positively and say this is the proposed amendment, then we move a little faster naturally that way. Let me allow Honorable Father Reyes to wrap up, and then allow Honorable Dexter. And say that if these are well-structured proposed amendments, then would actually want that to be submitted in writing for the benefit of our members. I think that interjection is very good.
Chief, can I just interrupt here? We were going to request that we need some more time to deal with this bill, and that we don't debate it next week. That's actually what we want to ask. Thank you.
Maybe that's what should have been the first element of us, but let me proceed with the fundamentation, and then I'll hear Honorable Dexter.
Thank you, Chair. I hope it will not take up too much time. I was realizing it was taking a bit long. Can I take you to page 15, right at the bottom of that page? The general objectives of the CETA are two, and something which I personally miss there is to contribute to the economic growth of South Africa. Perhaps I'm missing that, but I would love to see something to that effect in that long list of objectives there as well. Then also, Chair, alternates for accounting authority, and I'm now at the bottom of page 19 of the bill, the second last sentence there, 8b, the whole issue of alternates. I would love us to just pay attention to that, because alternates can be disruptive, and we will have to see. I would have loved us to just debate that point as well. Then the next one, Chair, when it comes to the Remuneration Committee and the Finance Committee, who must both submit financial statements, I would prefer us to include a word saying relevant financial statements. I think that would clarify. When people just speak of financial statements, you think of the full set of financial statements, in the old days called the income statement, the balance sheet, cash flow, etc. And I'm convinced that what we want of the Remuneration Committee would be things like, in terms of the wage budget, how we perform, please report to the Audit Committee in terms of number of posts filled, remuneration paid, etc. Okay. Then I think people have already spoken about the vacationing of office of a chairperson. It's not only the office of the chairperson, but what we pick up is that there is no deputy chairperson for the CETAs here. And only when the chairperson isn't able to attend the meeting will the meeting elect an acting chairperson, it seems, just for that meeting. So it might mean that the CETA is effectively for 6 months and longer, until the new chairperson has been brought in, without a chairperson. And the chairperson is also a person who should be setting the agenda for the meetings, etc., and approving of the agendas, etc., that driving force, and we're not going to see that probably. Then on top of page 26, I'm glad to hear that we must meet at least once a month for the executive committee. Our proposal would be at least six times a year, and perhaps we'll even bring in something like six times a financial year for that. And then another concern that I have on bottom of page 28,
is signatories to accounts. You'll see right there at the bottom, the last one say that the accounting authority must appoint at least three people as signatories for each account of the CETA, at least two of the three signatories, which must include the chief executive officer, must be required to authorize any payment made by the CETA. Now, chairperson, one of the main complaints that I'm receiving from the CETAs are that certificates are delayed and that payments are delayed. And the excuse is always that the person who must sign the certificates are not in the office, or is not in the office, or is not able to, you know, those things. And I think we must seriously reconsider, or ask the department to seriously reconsider this point. Because you can't have two CEOs. If the one is out of the office, you can have an acting CEO, but I'm not sure if this is covered by this the way this is stated in that paragraph. Thank you, Chair. I hope that the member Mfonshana will be and obviously we take the other amendments, the 5, which is a printing error, to which should be 6, etc. Thank you so much for
thanks, Chair. I think it's been a very valuable process because, as I said to you, in another life I had a lot to do with studying what was wrong with the CETAs and recommending the changes. And when I was at NEDLAC, we also dealt with those acts and, you know, the consequences of them. And you see, I think that we're sitting in a very difficult position because the legislation that's proposed, in a sense, it's a kind of a hybrid, and it takes from this old way things were governed with all the problems. And then it's like somebody came with sticky tape and tried to stick some things on. The problem is the architecture of the system. And it's only once you get the architecture right that you can draft the act to make that work. And I'm not criticizing the department. You know, in a sense, they've been handed a poison chalice. You know, it came from the Department of Labor, warts and all. So I think we're in a bit of a bind. And I want to suggest 3 things here that I think. The first is that, you see, if you want to draft legislation and put details in it, like you were saying, you're going to have problems. Not only are you going to have legal challenges, but when you can't implement it, then it means that the department is now breaking the law. So it doesn't matter if you say the minister has the power to deviate from the constitution. You can't do that. You can't say I'm drafting a law. The law applies to everyone except in this instance, that instance, and then hope that that is going to be an efficient system. What you're better off doing is saying less in the law and doing that in regulation. And I think that's an important principle about how you craft laws and making the law easier to administer. And I'm saying this not on our behalf as a committee. It's going to be the department that will suffer and the minister at the end. And as you know, there's no love lost between the minister and I. So when I give advice of this nature, you must know that I'm being very serious. The second thing is that, you see, if you consider what you're doing, you know, when you have a private company, it's very easy. There's a shareholder, you appoint a board, and you appoint an executive, and you say, I own this company, I want you to dig the gold out of the ground, sell it at the best price. If you don't, I'll fire the executive and get somebody else to do it. But here you've got a problem because the shareholders don't have the same interest. You see, business's interest is not exactly the same as labor. And I think government tries to encompass everybody's interest. But then you have this other animal called the community, which, you know, I know that contrary to popular public opinion of some of my colleagues in the ruling party, I'm still a Marxist. So there's a problem with this concept of community and civil society, because it's not easily defined. So when you start to create a structure like this, what you're doing is you're embedding conflict into the government structure. And that's a big problem. If you look at state-owned enterprises, for example, they had a similar problem. And part of the reform of state-owned enterprises was to take the shareholder role out and put it in the government and say to the minister, right, now you act on behalf of the shelter, but you have your board. What you must do with the state enterprise is the following thing, like Eskom. You must deliver electricity to people. Then you appoint people who can deliver the electricity. You don't appoint them because Labour likes them or somebody doesn't like them. But so I don't see how this legislation deals with that problem, as we were talking about before. Because the CETA has to do two things. It must deliver on its objectives. And at the same time, it must govern the money that is given to do that. And I think you've got to find a way to separate those two things out. And the current way it's drafted, it's cluttered. There's a saying that, you know, the simplicity is beauty. And in philosophy, it's called Occam's razor. They say, when there's a long, complicated explanation for something, and a simple one, normally the truth lies with the simplicity. And I'm worried, because I think that, so we've taken legislation that was defective, based on a defective system, and now we're tweaking it. And we're not addressing that fundamental problem. So I don't know how we address that here, because I think, you know, it comes up, as from my colleague's point, it comes up in a number of different places, and what you were saying when I came into the room. So, you know, I know we can't chuck out everything and say, start from scratch, but you've got to find a way to have a debate about the architectural problem of the system, and then say, based on that, how do you draft legislation the best? Ironically, I think, that you see, what they're trying to do is to centralize all the stuff and put the power in the minister's hands and put it into the act. You know, ironically, I think they're going to shackle the minister by doing that. What you're better off doing is saying, we enable the minister to set up the CETA, he must appoint a board, it must have X number of members, blah, blah, blah. He'll work out the constitution and he put it in the regulations, and that's a standard constitution. Then you can amend it when you see something going wrong, rather than now you must come back to Parliament and say, oh, you know, we thought it worked well, but now it's a problem. Then you have to have public hearings again. So I'm in favor of us looking at the bill and saying, let's concentrate what's needed in the legislation, which is empower the department to run, you know, to set up these structures, empower it to create the governance structures for it, and empower it to hold people accountable for the resources and the objectives. Then say, let us then spend time and look at how you make the regulations and you put in place the other enabling mechanisms. Because the fact that they're in regulations doesn't make them any less powerful. It just means that it creates more flexibility for you. And, you know, so I think the minister has been poorly advised, if I may say so, in the way that this has come out. Because ironically, none of us disagree on the objectives. No political party here doesn't agree with the need for skills development. So it's not an issue on which there would be some huge debate between the ANC, COPE, and the ID, and everybody fighting. We all want the same thing. The question is, what's the most effective way to get it? And I'm really afraid, Chair, that having looked at the bill again and having heard some of the comments and the public, what the, you know, the inputs made, that the department's now coming back and saying, no, our view is the best. And I'm not sure that it's based on any scientific assessment of what's really out there.
There are no further comments on the bill and the details that we have in front of us. May I just add that the main act, the Skills Development Act, also establishes the National Skills Authority and the National Skills Fund. And I do know, and I agree with the Minister, that we need to take the National Skills Fund and give it, it must become an entity, and that must have its own governance structure, I believe. And I think this is also an opportunity missed by not, you know, while we're busy with the Act, I think that that should have now been addressed in this revision that they have in front of us.
Let me allow the department to address the questions of the grammatical and typographical mistakes that have been noted by members, and clarify the issue which has always been coming up that they are working on a green paper and which issues are going to be addressed in that green paper. And then you can see if there are any aspects of this bill that you think deserve to be left for that process, then you can do so and proceed on that basis.
Thank you, Chairperson and honourable members. I think that the point that has been made with respect to the key challenge being the architecture of the system is a very valid one, and it's a problem that we're sitting with. And I mean, the minister is not here, but in the understanding is that most of this, the NFF, the NSA, the system as a whole would have to be addressed alongside the green paper process, because it's all the structures of the entire post-school system that needs to be relooked. So you can't talk about or relook the NSA without relooking at CHE, for example, because it's also an advisory body in a way. With respect to higher education, the university. So do we need all these advisory bodies? When we talk about the architecture of the system, the way the system has developed, and I don't know if it was the intention, but the way it has evolved and developed, it has evolved in such a way that it has distanced itself from the other institutions of higher learning. Now, we can't relook at the system, the skills development system, without looking at the FET system, the university system, and so on. So that is going to be part of the green paper process. It's a pity that it has to be done this way, that we do minor changes now and then we look at the major changes later. But I think the issue of the major changes of the entire system is going to be part of the green paper process, Chairperson. So for now, we're looking at how we make what we have currently a little bit more effective while we wait for that process. But it doesn't mean that we are not worried about all these other problems that we are sitting on. So I'll ask the advocate to respond to the specific.
First of all, the issue of the typographic mistakes in the bill. Chair, it is a document of Parliament. The status of it is formally tabled in Parliament. And Chair, there is a language services in Parliament who must take responsibility to quality control the legislation. Chair, it is issues and we can go through it again with them. I will contact the language services and ask them to really look at the bill. In fact, they're also responsible for the second language that's required in order to deal with the translation, and we will also read into that and ask them to identify any typographical or language errors so that it can be corrected during this process. The status of the law is disabled. It is an official law within the Parliament committees and Parliament committees that deal with it. The aspect of the other issues that have been raised, and Chair, it is very important that one must identify a very important principle, and that is when we deal with the Constitution as part of the bill, it is different approaches and there is different ways of dealing with it. That one must weigh it off against what would we want to achieve and what would create the least risk. So you're absolutely correct to say that the challenge in April was House against the minister taking a decision to implement a constitution which the act says the minister must approve. And the minister dealt with it in terms of saying, if I must approve, I can tell you what I want in the constitution because I must apply my mind and make sure that what you bring to me is not causing a dysfunction in the system. I must approve a thing which I'm satisfied with. And that is what I use. Bring your constitution, I approve as the minister, and this is the type of instrument that I am willing to approve. Chair, it didn't happen like that. Because it is a decision to be taken, it's an administrative decision. It is challengeable on the basis of exceeding your powers. Although the word is, you must approve. It is a very powerful word. Approve means you've got a final say, you've got a veto right to it. But Chair, it didn't work like it. We had to spend millions in court cases in order to deal with it. And the approach the minister took is to say, don't get the minister caught up in the fight. If it is an act of parliament which prescribes a standard, then it is the principle. It's not that it cannot be challenged in a court of law. That's the impression that's been created. I want to apologize. That was never my intention. That it minimalized the grounds on which that can be challenged. Because then it can only be challenged if it is unconstitutional to the constitution of the Republic of South Africa. It is not an administrative decision that's challenged, which got very a wide range of possibilities within which that decision can be challenged. And so even if it is a regulation, that regulation is also much more susceptible to a challenge because it is a discretion that the minister must take in order to formulate it. It must be within the prescripts of the Act. It allows for different interpretations. It also provides an opportunity for a person to go to court and say, Minister, you have interpreted your powers in the Act incorrectly, and therefore you acted outside your powers, and you declare the legislation or that regulation to be ultra vires, outside your powers. Chair, the intention of the minister was to say, the principle is standardization. Bring it in as a concept which is known. It will bring legal certainty. And Chair, it is important that when you deal with the so-called difficult areas or the sticky wickets, as they call it, that one must identify that. Chair, the major issue is the size of this authority. Chair, it is a very important principle that the smaller the number of membership, the more effective that structure will be. But it is also important that even though you can have an ideal, a standard, there must be a deviation. And Chair, it is not unique to this legislation to allow for a deviation. It is a concept that you would find in a number of legislation. The tax laws provide for a deviation where you can even put a moratorium under certain conditions. Actually, what is important, the enabling legislation will provide the authority to deviate from what is in the Act itself, provide also the objective criteria within which that decision can be taken, and it is limited in that the deviation, that decision to deviate within an objective criteria provided by the legislation, and it is not an open-ended or a blanket check given to an individual.
there can't be an unfettered discretion as the courts provided in judgments on their nature. So, Chair, it is a well-accepted principle. The concept of having a structure which is provided by law to a constitution is not a necessary bad process. You've already indicated that our own constitution of the land is for many years, in fact centuries, regarded as a document that should never be in legislation. The old Westminster structure was never contained in legislation. That is not necessarily the best approach. There is a movement to bring legal certainty, and legal certainty is a very important concept when you implement. So, Chair, linked to that, you must also acknowledge that when you work on a standard, there will always be an exception and always be something that you need to adjust. When you deal with that flexibility, that deviation, it must be structured to be meaningful. It must be structured to not become the norm, but to deal with the exception to the rule, and it must be based on objective criteria, which is not based on a subjective interpretation by the decision maker. And here, what is also further important is that when we deal with this approach of having the discussion to deal with should there be a constitution as part of the legislation and or be informed by the legislation, the question is always then what would be the remaining part within the legislation that would drive that constitution. Now, Chair, the legislation must deal with the composition, and Chair, it is dealing with that. It is also providing the structure within which the legislation identifies a very important aspect, and that is the size. It provides for the deviation, because you can't just leave that to a schedule in the legislation to deal with. It also provides for the functions. It provides for a number of important aspects that is critical to and inform what is in the Constitution. But your legislation cannot necessarily deal with the substructures as part of the main act. And Jay, it's also a very important issue. The frequencies of the meeting, as you said, it is also one of the critical areas that being identified as a problem is the lack of oversight and monitoring, where CETA's accounting authority never take charge of their very important responsibility. And when you bring that into the main act, it can be criticized. What we've done here is to identify what is critical, those areas that you can't go without, and that's in the main act. But the schedule, which is having a statutory structure providing additional information, is not clouding the main act, because it is separate to it in the schedule. It provides the best of two worlds. And Chair, it is the view of the Minister that to be caught up in court challenges on the powers that we use in order to make regulations, the cost of fending those challenges off in courts of law is not necessary in the public interest. And therefore, as a schedule to the Act, which is not part of the Act itself, but it is protected by the Act itself, provide a better option. Chair, the other very important issue that the members raised is the aspect of the discretion that the minister have in dealing with this deviation. Chair, if you look carefully worded to identify issues which is unique to that specific CETA. And Chair, when it comes to the word essential that the member also referred to, it is a well-known concept in law. When you deal with, for instance, the situation of enrichment, the courts and also legislation identify what is luxurious, what is necessary, and what is essential amendments required. So, Chair, what is provided here is to say that you would get a lot of requests which might be nice to have. Some of them might even be not, it will add value, but it's not essential. Chair, if you want to entrench the principle of a standard constitution, you must allow for essential changes, which is really needed. Otherwise, it becomes a farce to have a standard which no one adheres to. Then it's not a standard anymore. And that's why the word essential has been used. Chair, you would find the context of essential services and those things, once again, it is within the context. It comes down to what is the critical issues that needs to be protected. And it's usually linked to a very special type of deviation. And
let me assist you. In terms of the griefer process that you refer to, there is a specific area we want to deal with the CETA landscape. Fine. Actually, we're expressing our concern as a committee, and we need to go into that area. Remember the meeting that we had with the CEOs and so on and so on. There were a lot of issues that we raised that genuinely about the transformation of the sector related to the issues of mandatory grants, all those issues, the very issues that came in through a booster of the structure of. We need at one moment to go into those issues. Now, the committee is itching to deal with those issues, and the incremental approach that does not give us an opportunity to have a holistic attention to these issues is the one that will cause this tension. Now, the issue that we need to be resolved, and I wonder if it will be resolved within the program we have, the grammatical and typographical mistakes that are noted in the document are going to be dealt with. We, as a committee, raise concerns about the prescriptive meetings and all that. And I thought we would be having a specific proposal as to how you change that. Because it's a good thing to listen to what members say and then anticipate what they actually want, and you come up with it then to hope that you can still insist on a position to the committee. When the committee says, look, we understand the perspective of the stakeholders, we need to be articulated in your response, but it is not forthcoming. Let's get those proposals as to how we are going to refashion the aspect of meetings of this structure. This committee is there. We said those meetings are too many because it will end up doing administrative work. I think that is our context. We already see that. If it is a fact that then. And also see what the department wants to address to postpone the battle, the court battle with the CETA as fine by including the constitution as an identity. That's what I can see already. But we don't accept that argument. We accept an annexa for the certainty that there's a constitution. It has got elements which may not be extremely perfect, which we thought would be engaged upon with the stakeholders, private stakeholders, beyond the skills authority, because we don't think this authority is necessarily the institution that must determine the constitution of the CETA. You know, we thought we would engage in meaningful discussion with all the CETA boards, all the relevant stakeholders, and say this is what they collectively suggest we should have. There are proposals which are very valuable from Father Vincent, I guess you will make that available to us in writing. Secondly, that I know that we can do it. I don't know whether it's done already. How can we get that in the evening? We would like to see how we can factor the changes there. It's not a transmess to say may instead of must, where you are talking of the stakeholders. Because here we say it's parliament. You can add that and say may include this and that stakeholder. And that does not preclude that possibility that they will be included. But the must element of it expresses that very attitude of entrenching that system and all that. Those are the...
I want to maybe suggest a process. I mean, I can understand what the department is trying to do. As I said, they're in an ambiguous position. You see, if there's a process where there's some engagement, perhaps between yourself as the chair and the department, based on some of the proposals that we want to make, and you go back to the minister. I mean, I'll give you two examples in the response that we've received. You see, on the one hand, the department says, we want to put it in the bill because we want to give it force of legal effect. That's in relation to the Constitution. But when it comes to the meeting, then they say, no, we'll attach it as a schedule. My point is that you're adopting two different approaches in one piece of legislation. If the issue is giving the power to the minister, we're not fighting about that yet. But what we're saying is, do it in such a way that you don't cause problems. Because if you put the Constitution in the bill, it doesn't mean it's not subject to legal challenge. And all it means is that it goes to a higher court. So instead of fighting the battles in the high court, now you're going to go and fight them in the constitutional court. So I think the department must hear us. We're not against what they're trying to achieve. What we're not sure of is the wisdom of what they're doing. You know, you can do brain surgery with a meat cleaver. You can. You can chop a brain up with a meat cleaver. But it's not going to be very helpful when you try and put it back together again. You best use a scalpel, because that way the collateral damage is far less. And, you know, I mean, I'll give you another example. If you say, if you want the minister to have the power, but you've got to take into account what stakeholders say. There's a long tradition in this parliament. If you look at the president when he appoints SABC board, all these things, where you say, the minister will appoint a board after consultation with the stakeholders. Then it means that you don't have to sit here and say, okay, he must take 3 weeks and da 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 and put everything in the bill. You say, that's the minister, you say to all the stakeholders, nominate your names. Then you don't even have to say the size. You can say a minimum requirement of the size, like 4 members per constituency, and say, but the minister, after consultation, has the power to increase the number of boards, members, because in the steel industry, it's different from the hotel industry. So what we're saying is we get the problem, but we don't get in the bill that it's drafted to solve it. We're not objecting to the bill. We're not objecting to the principles, the philosophy. I mean, I haven't heard any members saying that. But we're saying the way it's done is not going to help us, because now in some cases, it's going to be prescriptive from the bill. In others, it's going to refer you to regulation. Why not craft simple legislation that empowers the minister and says, right, now, all your powers are in the bill. So it's got force of effect of law. You can't say that the minister will appoint the board after consultation. That's not challengeable in court. You know, the law is clear. And all he has to do is go through a process and say, okay, I ask for names from everybody. The same with all those things. And then you do that all the way through so that when you deal with the issue of discretion, because I think all of us understand that. The problem is that, why I said there's a problem in the architecture of the bill. It's saying that we need discretion because one size doesn't fit all. But by the way, here's that one size that all of you must fit. And that doesn't make sense, Chair. So all I'm saying is we can go on and on and on. I'd much rather we make, as you say, give the chance to make those proposals to you. Let you engage with the minister and the department. That way, at least, maybe it will be more productive than us sitting and going over and over in those things.
What do members say?
engage with the department.
The suggestion is that there are specific amendments that you really thought are necessary to be done, but now the department has not brought those proposals along, as it has been the practice with the previous two bills, where we went through those proposals and we adopted them. Now, that would be a requirement for us to say we've approved the final response of the department. So we need to be able to do that. And Parliament is rising when? Next week. And the difficulty is they would like this to go through because there is that structural stagnation in the city sector. So let's incorporate those proposals which we could now through the engagement with the team of Parliament and the team of the department. Make those changes within the framework of the bill that is before us. To achieve the perspective that ultimately ensures that the Constitution does not become an act of Parliament, but a regulatory framework that the Minister determines for the CETA system from time to time, as it is fit, as this system grows and must be shaped, so that what the moment it becomes part of the law, it becomes rigid now. For you to change a process of millions, so that's all we are saying. So we can have a clause that refers to say that the minister must prescribe a constitution, a standard constitution for the CETA that will, allow deviations that suit,
after consultation.
Exactly. Then we don't have to really have the constitution in there. Then we bring those elements that we think are necessary for the main act. For instance, if you would like to have a structure that must really be in the act, we can do that within the period that we have.